Nothing of importance happened today. So read an entry in the diary of a Parisian cobbler, Jean Lenoir, on July the 14th, 1789. Only a few streets away that same day, the French Revolution had been touched off as an enraged mob stormed the notorious Bastille prison, razing it to the ground and freeing its inmates. But in the opinion of an oblivious Frenchman, nothing of importance happened today. So it must have been when Jesus Christ was born in Bethlehem of Judea. A new world calendar was to come into being, starting from that event, and nobody knew it. Caesar Augustus was the most powerful man on earth. By the time he died, the child would be in his teens, and little did Augustus know that the only reason why his own name would be known at all 2,000 years later by Eskimos and Tibetans and Fiji Islanders and Londoners was that his craze to hold a census provided Luke with a date for the baby's birth. And so Augustus gets a single mention in the best-known half-page of narrative ever written in Luke chapter 2. In all, he ruled for 57 long years, but his only claim to worldwide fame today lies in his association with the child who started our calendar. Centuries earlier, a prophecy had been given. We were looking at it earlier on page 693. It had been given about this child in Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6, "For to us a child is born. To us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end." It's not unusual in certain parts of the world for babies to receive names that tie in with some peculiarity about their identity. A little Kikuyu boy was born years ago in East Africa in the back of our family car where we lived in Kenya. It was an emergency birth, of course, and it happened before the card had time to reach the hospital. So the mother gave him a name that tied in with the unusual event. She called him, well, I'll spell it, M-O-T-O-K-A, Motoka. Very apt, very wonderful. You know, the extraordinary thing about the Bethlehem baby is that his impact was being felt over 700 years before his arrival. What was his name? Why, he had many identification tags. True, his mother Mary, as we read in Luke chapter 1, was told that she should name him Jesus. But these sentences in Isaiah 9, verse 6, and elsewhere too, emphasize several things about this child. First, no name is big enough to define him. No one name, that is. No name is big enough to define him. In a previous chapter, Isaiah 7, verse 14, the prediction is given that a virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son and will call him Emmanuel, literally with us, God. God with us, Emmanuel. And you would think that this was enough by way of a name for a coming great one. But no, here in our passage of Isaiah 9, a fourfold compound name builds up the identity of the future child still further. With the help of Handel's great oratorio, the Messiah, this multiple name, why, it's resounded all over the world. In some of the most exhilarating and majestic music ever heard, Wonderful Counselor, the Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. But even without the music, the prophecy was there to light up Judah's dark night like a comet there in 730 BC. Assyria just then was dominating a whole of the political scene, the biggest armed menace that the world had ever witnessed. Heathen, unprincipled, contemptuous of every god and religion in sight except its own, Assyria was only the first of several terrifying empires that was to overrun the ancient people of God. It would be followed by Babylon, then Medo-Persia, after that the Greeks, and then finally the mighty Roman Empire with its swarming legions. For those who had the faith to see it, Isaiah's prophecies were to hold out a window of confidence to oppressed believers for centuries to come, including this century. They still do, you see. Can you recall of any modern thinker or writer who has the effect of inspiring people in the same way? For the most part, if there are such people, their impact is only for a few years. They may gain a footnote in history. Charles Wesley, 200 years ago, wrote 7,000 hymns. Some of them have survived. Hark the Herald Angels Sing was one of his best. Isaiah represented an incandescent light in a dark, dark world. And because he had a divine prophetic ability to kind of telescope his prophetic utterances across great tracts of time, why, his words keep speaking to generation after generation. Somebody's coming was the message drummed across the centuries. The wonderful counselor. And the Hebrew boffins tell us that the word wonderful used here occurs in 54 other places in the context where the great saving acts of God are to the fore. And the Hebrew word counselor describes the act not just of giving some counseling and comforting advice, but actually of changing a person's heart and character. This coming child will embody the mighty God himself, will bring the character of the everlasting fatherhood of God into the clearest focus ever known, and will be a prince of peace to troubled consciences and minds of every race and nationality. He'll be a universal figure. He'll be a permanent figure. I repeat, no name by itself is big enough to define him. Later on, in New Testament times, he would adopt for himself the name Son of Man, that divine irradiated figure of glory who features in Daniel chapter 7. Great prophecies. The book of Revelation would one day call him the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end, the bright morning star. Has there ever been an improvement on this person? Every day, between 80,000 and 100,000 people become his followers for the first time somewhere around the world. Every week, some 1,600 new congregations come into being somewhere. His is the largest family of faith anywhere. There never could be anybody else remotely like this person, around whom our thoughts, our devotion, our meditation, our prayers are centering right now. His statue is so great in history that no name is big enough to define him. And secondly, no reign is long enough to contain him. Because we read here in Isaiah chapter 9, verse 7, of the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. I mentioned the great kingdoms of Assyria and Babylon and Medo-Persia and Greece and Rome. All were destined to go down to oblivion eventually, and some of them went down in one day. But stretching across them would be the kingdom and reign that this child would represent embracing the rule of David as its royal symbol, but carrying it on far beyond the Old Testament confines and right into the world of Gentiles like myself. I remember standing recently looking across the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina in the USA, and stretching far into the distance was range after range of these beautiful ridges. Have you ever seen them? It was impossible to pick out the individual valleys that separated the ranges. Now, the prophet Isaiah in his own time couldn't distinguish the details, the valleys of the Messiah's rule. All he could establish was that it would stretch into the far misty horizons of eternity itself. No reign, no kingdom on earth would be long enough to contain him, because his rule would span the lot of them. But it would be a rule without armies, without the levying of taxes, a rule without border controls. Supremely, it would be a rule within the lives of individuals, Jews and Gentiles of every race. I remember when it became personal for me. It was an August evening, and I was on a house party. Some young people. I was tennis mad at the time, and I went to that house party to play tennis. I remember on those night prayers, we would meet together and we'd sing some songs, and as the custom was in those house parties, and then we would listen to a man speaking, and on that particular night it was a man called Mr. Nash. The passage that he used as his springboard, which prodded me into a decision of response to Christ, was, interestingly enough, from the prophecy of Isaiah. It was a later passage. In fact, it was the very one referred to earlier in our service by Iman Asher. Isaiah 53, verse 6. We have that verse in common. All we like sheep gone astray, we have turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him, the coming Messiah, the servant, the iniquity of us all. And I remember the man there at the front describing all this. I knew it. That's the strange thing. I'd been brought up in these things. I knew the language. But listening to that man, it was as though I'd never heard it before. And he put it like this, very vividly. He said, supposing this hand here represents you in your fallenness, your lostness, your guilt, all the things you've done wrong in your life. And he said, supposing this hand here represents Jesus Christ and his purity and self-sacrificial goodness. And he said, supposing the light up there represents God Almighty. And he said, supposing this black book, forgetting it's a book, represents the weight of your sin, your guilt, holding you down. All we like sheep, he said, have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way. And the Lord has laid on him the iniquity, the sins of us all. And then Mr. Nash looked to us and he said, there were about 100 of us in the room. He said, now what has happened to the responsibility of your sins? If Jesus Christ has done that on the cross, where are your sins? Will they ever be raised against you again? Ever? And of course I had to see the point. I did see the point. They were gone. He had done it. I listened avidly as Mr. Nash went on and said, then what do you have to do? What must I do if I'm to become one of his followers? He said, all you've got to do is to thank him for dying for you upon the cross, where there it was more than the agony of the nails through hands and feet. It was more the spiritual desolation of the whole weight of the sins of the world resting upon him. Him taking the divine judgment that we should have been taking instead of us. Mr. Nash said, all you've got to do is to thank him and then come to him and say, I'm turning to you. I'm yours from now on. I'm sorry that I've kept you at arm's length all these years. And as I listened, I thought, that is exactly what I'm going to do. I'm going to do what that man says tonight. I was far too shy to tell anybody else about it. So I just hugged it to myself that night, sitting up in bed. I asked Christ, the world's master, to become my ruler. As best I knew how. To forgive me for my sins and to come right into my life. I woke up the next morning thinking, I did it. I've done what I should have done. I didn't feel particularly different, but I look back to that as my landmark, very specially. Didn't tell anybody, didn't even tell my younger brother who was with me at the same house party, but the next day we met up together. He said to me, "That was a great talk last night." I said, "It was a fabulous talk." We didn't need to say anything else to each other. We both knew at that moment that the other had taken the same step, and later events confirmed it. If I had had a diary in those days, and I never did keep a diary, I suppose I could have written, "Something of importance happened today." I'm not saying that Jesus Christ had had no part in my life up till then, but that was the occasion when it became more personal for me than it had ever been before. And forever I'm indebted myself to the words of Isaiah chapter 53, verse 6, that were my kind of shoehorn into the Christian life. I say it again, no reign on earth is long enough to contain the rule of Christ, because his rule, essentially carried out in people's lives, will continue until the end of time. Its insistent summons stabs at us in this carol service. Now, with its great and mighty wonder, redemption drawing near, as the old carol has put it. And just which particular range of the Blue Ridge Mountains we're on at this particular moment, from Isaiah's standpoint, I wouldn't know. But for the moment, Christ's appeal speaks to one generation, our generation, situated as we are, and our particular reach. Give or take a few decades, it'll be another generation's chance. It's our chance now. And at this moment, the message reverberates across the ridges to us, through the carols and through the songs and through the little story that we were told by our Egyptian surgeon, by our meditation upon this passage. Each Christmas says, it's make up your time, make up your mind time, now. No name is big enough to define this Christ. No reign is long enough to contain him as he speaks to generation after generation. Thirdly, as I wind up, no power is strong enough to resist him. Back to Isaiah 9, where we have been meditating. Verse 2 again, the people walking in darkness have seen a great light. So certain is the prophet of fulfillment of his utterance. He writes as though it has already happened. It's what the theologians call the tense of the prophetic past. Isaiah goes on about those living in the land of the shadow, on those living in the land of the shadow of death, a light has dawned. Then centuries later, the father of John the Baptist, the forerunner of Jesus Christ, picks up the same phrase as in a moment of inspiration he declares, Luke 1, verse 79, that the coming of Christ will, and I quote, shine on those living in darkness and in the shadow of death. There it is again, the word death. However dimly Isaiah saw it coming, the prophecy was clear enough that in this child lay the answer to the things that most threaten us. What threatens you? What threatens me at this moment here in London? See, there are plenty of things that do threaten us, and they always have. And the most brilliant people we've ever produced in this world have failed to crack the puzzle. The puzzle about our existence, the puzzle about the meaning of life and where it's taking us, the puzzle as to how and where we're going to spend eternity, the puzzle about death. The great Socrates in 399 BC, as he prepared to die, said, "It is now time to depart, for me to die, for you to live. But which of us is going to do a better thing is uncertain to everyone." However clever they were, they didn't know a thing Voltaire, that stern 18th century critic of established Christianity, in a series of letters to a woman acquaintance, declared no less than 3 times, "I dread death and hate life." The Christian contention is that with the coming of Christ, to quote the old carol, "Now you need not fear the grave." He is the fulfillment of Isaiah 53, verse 6. By his suffering love, he has taken to himself the responsibility for the rebellion that he would otherwise have been obliged to shut us out of heaven with. And it's only when a man or woman keeps Christ at arm's length that his death upon the cross cannot touch us, will not help us. So our contention is that he is alive from the grave and beckoning across the blue ridges of successive generations to respond to what he came to do and to die for on our behalf. Some people say, there's plenty of time. I'll wait. I'll wait till later. You know, that people sometimes have said to me, I can always have a deathbed repentance. Don't you believe it? As a clergyman, I've seen hundreds of people on their deathbeds. Hundreds. It runs into hundreds. You know what? By the time that you and I are on our deathbeds, we shall be so pumped full of drugs that we'll be in no position to decide what we're going to have for lunch, let alone how we're going to spend eternity. The time is now. This is the time. For somebody, it's probably right now. See, in a congregation like this, we're all in different stages of procedure and excavation and examination of these matters. Some of us will be ready right now. And you can just find some good friend here at the front, or myself, or my colleague Rico Tice. He's going to come and join me at the front. You recognize him straight away. He's a rugby player. He's built like a rugby player. You'll see him, sure enough. Very gentle. But nevertheless, you can come and see one of us. Come down and have a word with us. See, it's now. The transference of guilt in Isaiah 53, verse 6, from one person to the other, to Christ, that I allowed Christ to take on my behalf those years ago, is a very urgent issue. And therefore, it's imperative that I do allow him to shoulder that burden for me. He's the great winner over death and darkness and guilt and despair and meaninglessness, and life does not have to tail off into emptiness. Kenneth Williams was a household name in the world of entertainment, featuring in many radio and TV shows. He used to live very near here. In fact, often I would see him walking along Great Portland Street. In fact, I saw him the day he died, walking along Great Portland Street just a few years ago. I remember I thought to myself then, he looks old and tired. And I felt sorry. The next morning I woke up, there was the front page. Kenneth Williams is dead. Then his family published his diaries. One August entry read, "I wonder if anyone will ever know about the emptiness of my life. I wonder if anyone will ever stand in a room that I have lived in and touch the things that were once a part of my life and wonder about me and ask themselves what manner of man I was, how to ever tell them, how to ever explain." In another entry he writes, "Today I was invited by Cliff Richard and Dora Bryan to meet Billy Graham. Has the world gone completely mad?" The last entry of all was perhaps the saddest. "Oh, what's the bloody point?" Well, it's not for us to dogmatize as to his particular state of mind. That's God's business. It's not ours. But there are hundreds of us here who have taken the best way. Indeed, some of you have told me your stories this past year, of beginning with this pivotal figure of our human story, the wonderful counselor, the mighty God, the everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace, whose rule is forever. No name is big enough to define him. no name by itself. No reign is long enough to contain him, for it is forever. No power is strong enough to resist him. Not the darkness of Isaiah's time, not the ridges that have challenged and flattened us across the high roads of time, nor the black holes of guilt and death and emptiness that laugh in our face today. How do we end our service then? By keeping our eyes upon those wonderful words there. I think that somebody probably put in your service order a little prayer. I wrote it about 3 days ago, a prayer at Christmas time. It's a very basic prayer. It's a prayer really for somebody who is an inquirer. You can take that prayer away. You can make it your own. And then over the page, there are one or two suggestions. Want to know more? Please come to our New Year series on life and how to handle it. Though we have another carol service this time next week with John Stott as our speaker. But there's an event there coming up in January, February, to make the most of it, or to sign up for one of these special courses that Rico Tice is in charge of. So maybe you're praying that prayer already, or something like it. Or somebody says, I'd like to come and pray that prayer with somebody here. Well, you can do that. We won't manipulate you. There'll be no buttonholing techniques, nothing like, I hate that. I couldn't have done it myself. I could not have seen anybody the night that I made my own step. But there may be somebody who says, I'd like to do that. Well, bring that prayer and show it to one of us here. There's Michael Leonard, my friend here, and one or two friends in the front. And what we can do is to give you a little gospel of Luke. Luke makes sense of life. You can take it away as our little Christmas gift to you. I put a few words of explanation on the back of that gospel. And maybe you'd like to ask for my little book that I wrote. It's called A New Beginning. And again, inside there is another prayer, this time of commitment rather than of inquiry. Which again, you may want to make your own Christmas prayer. Come down and see us at the end of the service. We'll be here. And as others go out and get coffee or whatever later, you can come and see us for a moment or two. Or write me a little letter explaining what's in your mind. It doesn't take much to tip one or other of us towards Christ, the ruler of the centuries. And in a moment, we hear the choir sing Mary's song of response and acceptance as the news of the impending birth was brought to her. And her prayer can be ours. Let it be to me as you have said, is what she prayed. Well, you see, ladies and gentlemen, it's either that or nothing of importance happened today.